November 1st, 2012, Vrindavan, India, Nectar Devotion, chapters 17 and 18, part 3, I think. So first thing I want to do is go over the questions from yesterday, and I had some very unusual questions yesterday. I was kind of surprised at some of these. How does a neophyte devotee perfectly practice to achieve bhava or the prema stage? So that we covered that earlier in the nectar devotion, the 64 angas of bhakti, avoiding offenses and like that. So if one does that, and then if one also comes to the point of raganuga bhakti, one can come, of course, through vaidya bhakti or raganuga bhakti. While we're studying material education, at the end we are attached to devotional service and leaving the material world. Point is, why ISKCON is not focused on gurukul education from childhood? I don't know if that's really so pertinent for this class. If you're interested, I don't know who wrote this, but if you're interested, I have a lecture on ISKCON Desire Tree about spiritual education, and I could recommend, and I put that on your box also. I gave that class in Mayapur a couple years ago. If somebody's feeling that during Mangal Arati, forgetting his body by meditating on Krishna, how can we keep it continue, and is it a symptom of bhava? No, it probably is not. It's probably not a symptom of bhava. It's probably just some natural reciprocation from Krishna that happens in the course of devotional service. Bhava is much more advanced than that. And you wouldn't ask, how could I keep it continuing? So bhava is continuous. Bhava is not interrupted. If you remember the meditation stages, so the bhava is way past the uninterrupted stage. Far past. Bhava is on the level where the spiritual world is manifesting in your heart. So the samadhi that happens at Ashakti is on the mental platform, and the samadhi that happens at bhava is on the spiritual platform. But both of those are past the uninterrupted stage. How can you keep it to continue? Well, that's what we discussed when we discussed the stages of meditation. How you gradually increase your meditation until it becomes uninterrupted. Of course, part of that is also Krishna. You can't demand that Krishna... you can beg him to stay. But what is special mercy? Special mercy, in other words, mercy is given to somebody who's not otherwise qualified. I know as a teacher, we teachers tend to give our most attention to the best students and the worst students. So sometimes you have a student who's so impossible that you give them a lot of attention just out of mercy. So sometimes it's like that. Sometimes that Krishna or the devotees may show mercy to somebody like Narada showed to Magrari the hunter. Yes?
That happens all the time, doesn't it?
What happens all the time?
Special mercy?
Yes. So then it's not special? But the point is that, in other words, there may be mercy given to somebody. I mean, mercy in one sense, the word mercy always implies that it's undeserved. That's the word, the difference between mercy and justice. Justice is deserved, mercy is undeserved. However, here when we talk about achieving bhava or prema by mercy only, so there's always some mercy involved, even if you're doing regulated devotional service. But if we're talking about mercy only, then we're talking about like Nagrari the hunter, who was a very sinful person and not engaged in any kind of practice, and Narada just gave him mercy. Of course, he took it. He accepted it. Just giving mercy doesn't mean that there's nothing happening on your side. But the way I understand this is sometimes as a teacher, I had students who were so incorrigible and impossible and hopeless that you might end up giving them special attention. Sometimes a hopeless case moves your compassion. So we can continue in Vaidya Bhakti, but if we have a keen desire to go for Raganuga Bhakti only, then we go for it. Now, since the destination for both the bhaktis are different, so how is it justified that every one of us has some real swarupa based on any one of the five rasas? Okay, we talked about this before, I think, quite at length. Is our rasa fixed, or is it a question of desire? So there's two possible ways to answer this. Prabhupada said earlier on in Nectar Devotion that even those who go to Vaikuntha may then progress from Vaikuntha to Krishna Loka. So it's entirely possible that a person in this life has no inclination for Raghunuga Bhakti, and they're performing Vaidhi Bhakti, they go to Bhava in Vaidhi, and they go to Prema in Vaidhi, and they go to Vaikuntha, and then somehow or other in Vaikuntha, maybe Gopa Kumar comes to Vaikuntha, and somehow they get some association with some Vrindavan Vasi, or somehow or other they go from Vaikuntha to Vrindavan. So even if they've come to Vaidhi Prema, they may still not be at their final destination. But there's a relationship between this is your fixed rasa and this is the rasa that you want. Both of those things exist simultaneously. It's your fixed rasa because it's what you want eternally. It's not your fixed rasa because it's assigned to you and you don't like it. It's not like that. It's not like I just say, okay, you've got to clean the dishes and you have to clean the cups and you have to clean the floor and you go, no, I don't want to clean the floor. It's not like that. It's something fixed because it's coming from you. So it's very possible, in fact, it's likely that in this life, as you progress, unless there's something really pushing against it, that your natural fixed rasa, which is your own desire, will manifest. A devotee is getting some ideas that he may be in some particular rasa with Krishna, like Raghunuga Bhakti, but after knowing or hearing that this may be starting of Raghunuga Bhakti, he is something to follow the methods for that by thinking that his ideas must be speculation and he can't start the Raghunuga Bhakti. Then what is that and what should he do? It's certainly understandable that at the beginning of Raghunuga Bhakti a person may have some confusion. First of all, at the beginning of Raghunuga Bhakti you're supposed to be basically free from anartas, but you're feeling very humble so you don't think you're free from anartas. And you may think, well, what I'm experiencing must be speculation, it must not be real. But as I said, a spiritual experience is obviously a spiritual experience. It has a different quality than a material experience. It just does. Any spiritual experience has a different quality than any material experience. Even, you know, you're just eating a gulab jamun and you all of a sudden experience, wow, this is amazing. And it's a different experience than eating some unoffered gulab jamun. So if you have a genuine experience of an awakening of a particular rasa, not just an experience of great happiness or just some experience that, oh, Krishna's very nice, but an awakening of a particular mood towards Krishna, that's the beginning of Raghunuga Bhakti. Yes, later on your mind will tell you, oh, it's all speculation, it's all the mind, don't do that. That's true. Prabhupada says that devotional service practice like university study for all, where is the mistake after education? I'm not sure what this means. We are not getting a certificate of prema or bhava. Prabhupada says you don't need a certificate, you know yourself whether or not you've achieved it. That's your certificate. To firmly fix in devotional service to the Lord, the influence, oh, this is a good, very good question. The influence of the modes of material ignorance and passion disappeared, why mode of goodness is not included? Because one hasn't surpassed the mode of goodness when you're fixed in devotional service. When do you surpass the material mode of goodness? At what stage? Bhava. When you're fixed, you surpass the mode of passion and ignorance. You're situated in goodness, but you're not situated in pure goodness. Explain more. The causeless mercy can be divided into three groups simply by speaking, simply by glancing, simply by good wishes. In other words, how is the causeless mercy of a devotee or Krishna, how is it communicated? It's communicated that simply Krishna or the devotee is thinking, wow, you know, I'd really like for this person to attain prema. Or just the devotee, person just sees Krishna. They just look at Krishna and it's awakened. Or the devotee says, I want this person to attain prema. So the devotee can say it, the devotee can think it, or there can be looking. The reflection of Bhava Bhakti is somebody who's very serious. very serious about devotional service, but they're serious for material reasons. They're not serious for spiritual reasons. But because they are serious and they're in association with a great devotee, they experience some of what that person experiences. I mean, look, even materially, if you're around happy people, you may feel happy. And if you're around depressed people, you may feel depressed, right? If you're around angry people, you may feel angry. If you walk in a room where people have been arguing, you may feel tense. Correct? Do we pick up on other people's emotions? So why can't that happen spiritually also? And the fact is that it can. How do we develop bhava bhakti? That we described in detail yesterday. We develop bhava bhakti through following sadhana bhakti, either vaidhi sadhana or raganuga sadhana. On this interesting question, bhava bhakti is authorized in ISKCON. I hope so. We are going to say, no, this is the International Society for Krishna, don't be conscious of Krishna. The International Society for Don't Fall in Love with Krishna. So, yes, we want everybody in the ISKCON movement to experience prema bhakti. And if everybody experienced prema bhakti today, that would be lovely. Interesting question. I think what this person is asking is sahajiism authorized? But sahajiism is different. So fake bhava is not authorized, but real bhava is authorized. We want the real deal. We don't want the fake deal. We don't want people just pretending to be in love with Krishna, but we do want people to be in love with Krishna. When tears come out for the eyes, are we in bhava bhakti? No, you may just have hurt your foot. If you're in bhava, you will cry, but if you cry, you may not be in bhava. It's logic. Okay, if it's raining, there must be clouds, but if there's clouds, it may not be raining. Right? If it's raining, there must be clouds. However, if there's clouds, it may not be raining. This is logic. If you're in bhava, you will cry. If you cry, it doesn't mean anything. It just means you're crying. Maybe your dog died or somebody stepped on your toe. Or...
Bhava for something else.
Huh?
Bhava for something else.
Yes. Bhava for something else. You ate too many chilies. You know. You're crying for the chilies.
Yeah.
So many people in the world are crying. They're not in bhava.
I heard some Bhagavatam researchers, they do that. They smear chili under the eyes before.
No comment. Is the symptoms like shivering and tears and samadhi authorized in our society? No, no one's allowed to go into samadhi. Yes! Yes, we want to be in samadhi. We want to cry for Krishna. And we don't want people going, oh, Krishna, in public. I mean, if it happens, it happens. But generally, we're not... The great devotees, they try to restrain... Just like, come on, this is... It's a private love. It's private. Just like even between a husband and wife, in a civilized society like India, husband and wife don't show intimate affection in public. In the West, they do. They don't even have to be married, but in India, they don't. So you see a husband and wife, you hope, anyway, that they have some intimate affection, right? You hope they don't, as soon as they close the door and go in their room, they just yell at each other and throw pots at each other. You hope in their private life they have affection. And you see some of that in public. There's some evidence, if you're with a married couple who like each other, there's some evidence in public that they have affection. But they limit, if they're civilized, they limit what they display in public. Does that make sense to everybody?
They did that. I mean, in the West, that was also, you know, prominent, let's say, what, 50 years ago?
Yeah, but still. I mean, it's not so uncommon in the West to see people. I know, I spend time in London. You see all kinds of things on the street. So when you're in love with Krishna, you don't want to display your intimate feelings publicly. But sometimes it may happen. Sometimes it may be uncontrollable. Maybe Krishna sometimes wants everyone to know, this one is mine. But yes, it's authorized. We should be in samadhi. We should cry for Krishna, definitely. What about seeming ecstatic symptoms that appear in non-devotees? So like when they win a football game or something. So there's some... Prabhupada said everything in this world is just the 12 rasas. But there's a perversion. So there's something. People in this world, they shiver, they cry. Prabhupada talks about the symptoms that Arjuna showed on the battlefield. Right? His mouth was drying up. I forget what it was. Oh, I know what it was. I was bringing my granddaughter here from America. And she has a visa for India. And somehow the people on the airline, they didn't like her visa. They said, this is not the right kind of visa. We're not going to let her onto the plane. And her parents were here in India. I'm with her in America, and my daughter and son-in-law are here in India. Plus, I had another grandson who was meeting us in Shanghai. My grandson who's here with us. First time he was flying along, he was meeting us in Shanghai. So I thought, I can't stay in America with my granddaughter, because if I stay in America with my granddaughter, my grandson will be in Shanghai alone. And if I go to Shanghai to meet my grandson, I have to leave my granddaughter here alone. So I didn't know what to do. And, you know, the plane's going to be boarding. The time is going. And they're saying, I'm very sorry. We're not going to put her on the plane. We can't accept it. And I was going to call my daughter, but in India it was midnight. And they weren't answering the phone. So I'm calling, and they're not answering. And I had only one other number in Mayapur. I was calling that number. And I found out later it was someone who's very sick and can't walk very well, but I didn't know this person. So I called her. I said, can you find my daughter? Oh, I don't know where she lives. I've never met her. I don't know what her name is. You know, this was happening. And so my mouth was drying up. My heart was beating. I was perspiring. You understand? But I wasn't in ecstasy. I was just in fear. I mean, it's funny. I was thinking, because I think it was the first time that my throat had dried up in my life. And I thought, oh, and Arjuna was on the battlefield. His throat was drying up. His bow was slipping from his hand. And I could hardly function. I could hardly think. I was like, Krishna, 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 Krishna. But I wasn't in bhava. I was just scared. So non-devotees can experience all sorts of perversions of the sattvic bhavas. It doesn't mean that they're in love with Krishna. How does real bhava begin? Ooh. So basically one at the point of a shakti gets into samadhi, into a total absorption in Krishna. But it's on the platform of the mind. And then the ray of Ladini Shakti enters the heart of the devotee. Krishna becomes attracted, basically. As Lord Kapiladeva says, one uses the mind as a hook to capture the Lord, Krishna becomes attractive. A ray of Ladini Shakti enters the heart of the devotee, and the mental meditation becomes replaced with the real thing. It doesn't turn into the real thing, it's replaced by the real thing. Well, the two divisions of regulated principles, Vaidhi Bhakti and Raganuga Bhakti, one motivated by duty and awe and reverence, one motivated by attraction of Krishna's sweetness. How ecstatic love and pure love for Krishna differ in quality? So ecstatic love is the beginning, it's the bud, pure love is the fruit, it's mature, it's final. In Bhava Bhakti, one will see the Lord in the heart and the Lord's manifest pastimes in the heart. In Prem Bhakti, one will see the Lord face to face. This is described in Madhurya Kadambini. One will not start Raganuga Bhakti until liberation. How do we categorize those who are very inspired to follow a particular mood of a devotee in Vraj, following their footsteps sincerely, but at the same time have material desire? Answer? We discussed this at length. Answer? Okay. Prabhupada says, one will not start Raganuga Bhakti until liberation, unquote. How do we categorize those who are very inspired to follow a particular mood of a devotee in Vraj, following their footsteps sincerely, but at the same time have material desires? What is the answer?
They're not qualified to follow Raganuga.
Someone else. Someone else's opinion.
Gradual.
It's gradual. Do you have to be free from material desires to start Raganuga Bhakti? No. Don't have to be free. Yes, thank you. That is the point. Can't be. How could you be? How do we know that you don't have to be 100% free from material desires to start Raganuga Bhakti? What's our evidence? Well, okay, but that's starting Uttam Bhakti. You can't be doing bhakti for some material motive. But there's a difference between having material desires.
You can have material desires.
You will have material desires. Otherwise, you're saying only pure devotees can start pure devotional service. Otherwise, if we say you can't have any material desires, we'd say the only people who can do pure devotional service are people who are already pure devotees. Okay? The point is, you're not doing devotional service with a material motive. You're not worshiping Krishna to get money. You're not worshiping Krishna to get health. You're not worshiping Krishna to get fame. You may still desire money, health, and fame, but that's not your purpose for worshiping Krishna. You're worshiping Krishna to fall in love with him. But how do we know that the qualification for Raganuga Bhakti does not involve the total cessation of all material desires? How do we know that? Yes?
There's the example of Bhagavan. He was in Baba above and he still had material desires.
Okay, but let's not take Bart as the exception, because Bart's an example of someone who, although was in Baba, still had some temporary difficulty. That's going to be an exception. What's the qualification for starting Baba as distinct from the qualification for starting Raganuga?
Desire for a particular rasa.
That's Raganuga.
Yeah, Raganuga.
That starts at beginning Raganuga.
Oh.
What's the qualification for starting Bhava?
Above the modes.
Soft-heartedness. Soft-heartedness from being above the modes. So at the beginning of Raganuga, are you above the modes? You're
in
material goodness. But starting Raganuga, are you above the modes?
No.
So what does Prabhupada mean by liberated?
Who's in goodness?
Who's in goodness? Who's liberated from gross anartas? In other words, you cannot start Raganuga Bhakti if you are doing what? Yeah. Well, if you're doing what kinds of things? Give me an example. Yeah. If you're smoking, you can't start Raganuga Bhakti. If you're having illicit sex, you can't start Raganuga Bhakti. You can't say, okay, I have 5 girlfriends and I'm going to start Raganuga Bhakti. You have to be free from gross sinful activities, and you have to be... Are you totally free from the modes of passion ignorance? Nasta prayeshu badreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavata uttama sokya bhakti bhavati naishtaki. You're mostly free, huh?
Yeah, almost completely.
Almost. It's not very important. It's not very consequential. But no, you're not fully free. And in fact, interesting, Prabhupada, if we're going to say Raganuga Bhakti starts at Nishta, which is, you know, most of your anarchas are gone, Prabhupada would say that 75, sometimes he would say 75% pure. If you look at Madhurya Kanambani, it looks like it's about 40 or 50%. So people starting Raganuga Bhakti, are we assuming that they're probably still going to have some material desires?
Yes.
Yes. What about starting Baba Bhakti?
No.
Exactly, no.
They don't identify with the body.
They're not identifying with the body or the mind. They're in a transcendental state. They might still have something. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, when you take camphor out of a pot, the smell is still there. So in Bhava, there may be some trace. Some trace, some spot. But it's there's practically no meaning to it. Again, you're cleaning a pot, you're scrubbing a pot, and maybe there's one teeny tiny little speck of black here and there. You follow? So not 100%, but you could even say, okay, now we'll cook with it. You follow? Everybody follows? Raghunuga Bhakti, you're seeing enough of the pot that you get a sense of who you are. And then Raghunuga is a process. Raghunuga starts with a feeling of rasa. Okay, what I would like to do because we lost a class to Maharaj. What I'd like to do, because chapter 19 is very, very quick, it's not very involved, and it's not that different from chapter 17, I want to quickly go through 19 now, and then give you a break, and then I'm going to ask you to do your presentations on the 9 symptoms of bhava, and then I can speak briefly on anyone that none of you do a presentation on, and then I will take a very short break, and then I have the other presentation on sex desire that I'll do. So, prema bhakti, let's look at chapter 19, and probably you haven't read this for today, but that's all right. You can read it after today. Here we're talking about the desire to love Krishna and your relationship becomes intensified. So when did that start? At the beginning of? Raghunuga. Now it's become very intensified. Remember, we're talking about making burfi, right? And you're doing it uninterrupted, and then it gets more and more and more and more concentrating. It's like burfi. Now it's super intensified. So you have a taste and attachment that were there in Raghunuga as Ruchi and Ashakti. They when gradually intensified in the course of time, become love. Then Prabhupada says that the word love can only be applied to Krishna, that what we have in this world is not love. Of course, there may be some bits and ideas of love. We're not saying that there's nothing ever that has anything to do with love. But still, on the whole, like Prabhupada would say, the love of the mother for the child is close to pure love. But even that is not pure. The mother's loving the child because the mother feels the child is part of her body. And sometimes mothers say, I don't love you anymore. I wanted you to be a doctor, and instead you became a Hare Krishna, and now I don't love you anymore. So, you know, it's not really pure love. But there's some. We can have some idea in this world, a little bit. A little bit. 1 billionth, you know, some idea. But Prabhupada says, your love is not applicable at all. What goes on under the name of love in the material world is nothing but lust. He compares it to gold and iron. So here they're giving a definition of prema. It's on page 143. When lust is completely transferred to the Supreme Godhead. So we'll be looking at that tonight in the presentation here at 4:30. Interesting. When lust is completely transferred to the Supreme Godhead, and the concept of kinship is completely reposed in him. So this we find Bhaktivinoda Thakura singing Janaka Janani Daita Tanai Prabhu Guru Pati Tuhu Sarva Moi. You're everything. Excuse my terrible Bengali pronunciation. But you're everything. You're my mother, you're my father, you're my brother, you're my sister, you're my lover, you're my son, you're my guru, you're my friend. Any idea of relationship, that is in Krishna. Then Bhisma has explained that love of Godhead means completely giving up all so-called love for any other person. According to Bhisma, love means reposing one's affection completely upon one person, withdrawing all affinities for any other person. Now, we talked about this before, but just a reminder. So if I only love Krishna and I don't love everybody else, does that mean I'm hard-hearted to everybody else? What happens when I only love Krishna and I don't love anybody else? What happens to my feelings for everybody else? You then love everybody else. Huh? I only love Krishna, I don't love everybody else. What happens? You love everybody else. That's like you only put food in the mouth. You don't put food in any other holes. You don't put food in the ears, you don't put food in the nose. And when you only put food in the mouth, you love the whole body. Exactly like that. If you decide, from starting today, I will only put food in the mouth. I will not put food in my eyes. And then you actually love the whole body. Bhishma loved the Pandavas. He was crying in affection for the Pandavas. Why? Because he only loved Krishna.
Because everyone is part of Krishna.
Exactly. I was giving this example, I think, in my Bhagavad Gita class, so I don't know if you all heard it. So nowadays in society, there's a lot of broken families. So people, they get married, then they get divorced, then they get married again, then they get divorced, and so forth. So Prabhupada gives the example, when you get married, when you love your husband, you naturally then have a relationship with your mother-in-law, father-in-law, brothers-in-law, right? Immediately, you have a relationship with the whole family. Now, of course, in the material world, we don't always like that. I may love my husband, but not love my brother-in-law or my mother-in-law. But that's the idea. I love my wife, I will love my wife's mother, my wife's sister, my wife's brother. I love my husband, I will love my husband's brother, and so forth. Now, we can see how this works with these broken families. So I read an article not too long ago how, you know, people, they get married, they have children, then they divorce. Then they marry someone else who also has children. So that means they're stepbrothers, you know, true stepbrothers, and they're growing up in the same house, maybe 10 years, right? And they have a relationship with their stepmother or the stepfather, then again divorce, because second marriages are more likely to divorce than first marriages. So then you have an ex-stepbrother. You understand? So for 10 years you lived with your stepbrother from the time you were 7 until you were 17. You shared a room with your stepbrother. Now he's your ex-stepbrother. Or you have an ex-daughter-in-law. Or you have an ex-step-grandchild. You know? And people don't know, what is my relationship with my ex-step-grandchild? When my ex-step-grandchild gets married, do I go or do I not go? You follow? So as soon as the main relationship is spoiled, all the other relationships become problematic. That's the point. When the relationship between the husband and wife is spoiled, then all the other, you don't know what to do anymore. Do I write to my ex-step brother who I lived with for 10 years? I grew up together. Do I talk to him? You know, now his mother and my father, they hate each other. Do I still call him? But when the primary relationship is good, all the other relationships, ideally, I mean, obviously they're not necessarily materially, but the idea is when the primary relationship is good, all the other relationships fall into place. And when the primary relationship gets spoiled, all the other relationships become a problem. So in this way, when you love Krishna, you love everybody. And if you don't love Krishna, you can't love anybody. Okay, how do you come to prema? You come to prema through bhava. And you can come to prema just like through bhava. You can come through Vaidhi bhava or Raganuga bhava. So there's two examples. One Vaidhi bhava on page 144. When it comes to Vaidhi prema, someone who's just following the regulated principles of devotional service. Then we have someone who comes to prema through Raganuga bhakti, Chandrakanti. So Chandrakanti, who never married. She, from the beginning, she was thinking of Krishna as her husband. That's Raganuga Bhakti. She's thinking, Krishna is my husband, Krishna is my husband. She was always meditating, Krishna is my husband. And from that she came to prema. So one devotee coming to prema through following the principles from Shastra, and one coming to prema from Raghunuga Bhakti. Then, of course, there's also people who come to prema, directly to prema, just through special mercy. That's extremely unusual. Right? And Prabhupada's making the point that if your prema is veneration for the Lord's Majesty, that's Vaidhi, and you go to Vaikuntha, or maybe Dwarka. If your prema is attached to the Lord's sweetness, that's Raghunuga, or Ragatmika Bhakti at this point, and you go to Vrindavan. Okay. And then there's a whole summary of the process of Shraddha to prema. That one first has some faith, then one associates with devotees, one accepts a guru, one takes initiation, one follows the process, one gets rid of the dirty things in the heart, one becomes steady, one gets some taste, one has some attachment, then one comes to bhava, then one comes to prema. And Prabhupada says here, or Rupa Goswami is saying here, that if you want more information on this development, you should go to Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So, of course, we now have our translation by Gopi Pranayana Prabhu of Brihad Bhagavatamrita. And also, I'd say another place, if you really want to look at the stages, you want to look at Madhurya Kadambini. So if you want more explanation of prema, you can go to Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Then really the rest of this nectar devotion, which we don't study in Bhakti Shastra, is about prema. And to some extent about bhava. So it's about the, and even to some extent about Raghunuga Bhakti. So part two is about the components of rasa. The five components of rasa. And then we're also reading about the five primary relationships, the seven secondary relationships, and then interactions of those. So this gets into more detail about having a relationship with Krishna that would start at when one is basically past anarjana vritti and end in prema. But that we do not study in this course. And what we're going to do tomorrow is, I want to do a summary. This should help you all who are going to take the exams. Originally, I was going to do chapter 19 tomorrow, and then I lost my summary class. I decided chapter 19 was so short, and there wasn't really that much different than what was in the chapter on Bhava Bhakti, so I wasn't really going to. There wasn't a necessity for a whole class on it. So tomorrow we're going to be, if you have any questions on anything that we discussed in the Nectar Devotion, you should bring that for tomorrow. And then we're going to summarize the Nectar Devotion. And I'm going to be asking everyone to give some sort of summary, at least just briefly. We'll just go around the class and ask everybody, okay, what's your summary? And you should be able to know what's in the different chapters. We may even play that game again. We walk around the room and you ask people what's in the, you know, give a summary of each section so that you can remember. Now, summaries, by the way, who gives summaries? Where in the Shastra do we find summaries?
10th canto.
There's, yes? Where else? Where can we find summaries? Bhagavad Gita. Krishna summarizes at the end.
In
the second chapter, he gives an overview, and in the 18th chapter, he gives a summary. So my public speaking teacher used to say, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. So that's what Krishna does in the Bhagavad Gita. So this is the basic subjects, then he tells it, then he summarizes. Where else do you find summaries?
Is it Bhagavad Gita?
Yes, you could say that. Although it's not exactly like that.
Bhagavad Gita,
Oh, it is true that many of the final purports in the Bhagavad Gita are summaries. Yes. Many, I'm not sure if all, but many of the chapters, the last purport summarizes a chapter. Where else do we find summaries?
Nectar of instruction.
The nectar of instruction summarizes the whole process of bhakti?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yes. There are also some purports there where Prabhupada does that. Which is a whole summary itself. The whole book is a summary. Where else do we find summaries?
Srimad Bhagavatam. There is in front of, at least from, is it third canto up to something?
There's a summary at the beginning of each chapter, which is, that's an initial summary. So there's before you talk about something, you may summarize it. and afterwards. We did that at the beginning, didn't we? Also in the introduction, these are the parts of the ocean, and these are the waves, and this is what Nectar Devotion is going to cover. So we did that kind of summary in the beginning. Where else is there a summary? Oh, it's a book you all know, I'm sure. Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Krishna Das Kaviraj has a whole chapter to summarize Adi Lila. He has a chapter to summarize Madhu Lila, and he has a chapter to summarize Ancha Lila. Why am I saying this? This is just in case any of you think, oh, tomorrow's a summary, no need to come. So summaries are good, they're important, and that's why I brought this up. And it really helps you to learn. So Krishna summarizes, Prabhupada summarizes, Sukadeva Maharaj summarizes, Krishna Das Kaviraj summarizes. It helps you solidify what you're doing. So if any of you ever teach, do remember that. Good teachers summarize. Good teachers summarize. So I thought better to go through chapter 19 briefly today and have our summary tomorrow. Otherwise you're like, what was in chapter 3? What did we talk about before? How was that? Huh? With Kali Yuga brains. I have a Kali Yuga brain too. I'm not criticizing anybody else. I have as much a Kali Yuga brain as anybody else. Okay, let's take a break until 3:40. And then we'll come back and we'll discuss the 9 aspects of Bhava.